Greetings and felicitations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this May 2011 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening of scientific conjecture and spectacle, Jim Campanella. Hello, all. I hope that spring is going well for you up here in the Northern Hemisphere. And yes, I do realize that it's fall below the equator. And I hope also that you're enjoying these relaxing days before either the dog days of summer or the cold blasts of winter. You will notice that I have seldom spoken about my own scientific research in all the time that I have done this podcast. Part of that is because I'm not sure that anyone would be interested, because it is the kind of abstruse stuff having to do with plant hormone physiology that not many people would want to hear. It's the kind of stuff that even people in my own field yawn over. I still remember my doctoral advisor snoozing at seminars. What was amazing was that he always asked these penetrating questions of the speakers, even though he was apparently dozing through the whole talk. I still don't quite understand that conundrum. Anyway, I was invited to speak at a conference, which I went to yesterday. Because my work tends to be quite academic and not so applicable, I do not get invited to speak at many conferences. I was obviously quite pleased to be invited to this one. The name of the conference was the State of the Bay Conference. What bay are we talking about? Well, Barnegat Bay. Barnegat Bay is the long bay that runs along the coast of New Jersey. The Jersey Shore, as it is called around here and in that horrid reality TV show with Snooki and The Situation. Ugh. Barnegat Bay is a small brackish arm of the Atlantic Ocean, approximately 30 miles long and about 10 miles wide. It runs along the coast of Ocean County, New Jersey, in the U.S. It's essentially a long estuary formed by Barnegat Peninsula, a long barrier peninsula, as well as the north end of Long Beach Island. The bay is fed by several small rivers, including Toms River, which empty into the bay through small estuaries along its inner shore. The communities of Toms River, Silverton, and Forked River sit on the river estuaries on the bay. The bay is entered from the ocean through Barnegat Bay Inlet, along which sits the Barnegat Lighthouse. The bay is part of the Atlantic Intracoastal Waterway, entered on the north end by the Point Pleasant Canal and connected on the south end with Little Egg Harbor via the small Manahawkin Bay. In a broader sense, the bay is sometimes considered to stretch to the south end of Long Beach Island, and to include Little Egg Harbor. The area surrounding Barnegat Bay and Barnegat Inlet were described by Henry Hudson in 1609 as a great lake of water as we could judge it to be. The mouth of the lake hath many shoals, and the sea breaketh on them, as it is cast out of its mouth. The bay was originally discovered in 1614 and was called Barendegat, or the Inlet of the Breakers, by the Dutch settlers, referring to the waterway's turbulent channel. And during the American Revolutionary War, the bay was actually used as a refuge by American privateers. As with lots of similar places along the east coast of the U.S., Barnegat Bay is in serious ecologic trouble right now, not just because of natural privations, which are always present, but a whole bunch of mistakes humans have made over the last 50 years or so have just worsened the situation. I was asked to speak on my research for this conference and to also be part of a panel discussion because some of my work involves a study of the population genetics of eelgrass, known to scientists by the species name of Zostera marina and to the public as seaweed. Okay, I can hear you snickering out there. Campanella does research on seaweed. Is he serious? Well, my Padawans, you may snicker all you want, but let me tell you a bit about eelgrass. Eelgrass is like the canary in the mine when it comes to the health of a marine coastal region. Back in the 1940s, there was a pandemic that killed off like 70 to 80% of the world's population of seagrass by a fungal pathogen called wasting disease. And these die-offs have only gotten worse over the last 70 years, because of things that humans have done. Zostera needs clear, cold seawater to grow. It grows from northern Canada and North America down to North Carolina here. As the water becomes more turbid and full of nasty things like algae, the grass beds start to die out due to limited oxygen and limited sunlight. Low oxygen levels are linked to phytoplankton blooms and macroalgae. These micro and macroalgae bloom when high levels of human waste or fertilizer from farms run off to the ocean and increase the nitrogen levels. Nitrogen levels in water also increase from far too many cars, buses, and trucks in the area. And additionally, they increase when the area on the shoreline gets built up with homes and businesses and roads. What happens is you lose the natural watershed with all its trees and plants. Loss of those trees and plants means that nature is no longer soaking up all that extra nitrogen and using it as fertilizer and getting it out of the groundwater. Well, the population around the bay has soared towards 600,000 in the last couple of years, and a great deal of the watershed has been paved over, causing storm drains to funnel more nutrients straight into the bay. Since 1995, development has grown in the area around Barnegat Bay by 25-30%, replacing the woodlands that once soaked up all that water. The U.S. Geological Survey in 2009 estimated 1.43 million pounds of nitrogen were coming into the Barnegat Bay estuary on a yearly basis. This all leads to algal blooms, which again leads to anoxia and water turbidity, which again leads to dead aquatic plants. Once the grass beds pack it in, then you lose a primary nursery for all sorts of marine animals, from small fish to clams and mussels and scallops. Of course, the process is like a snowball going downhill. It just gains momentum, making itself more unstoppable as it continues if it's not intervened with. Seagrass meadows in Barnegat Bay have lost 50-88% of their plant mass since 2004. This is an absolutely critical indicator of the bay's declining health. Dr. Mike Kenish, one of the other speakers at the conference from Rutgers University, made it clear that the seagrass is physically not doing well. He says that the grass beds are, quote, frayed like old doormats, unquote, and no longer luxuriant anymore. This is at least in part an indication of a serious loss of biomass. Biomass is the actual weight of the eelgrass calculated from samples, which measures length and lushness. These biomass values have declined to their lowest levels ever measured, says Kenish. He says that the grass bed biomass has declined in 6 years, since 2004, by 87.3%. Almost as bad, the root systems underneath the soil of these plants, their mass have declined by about 64.7%. Now, I am not an ecologist, despite what the Asbury Press called me when they wrote an article about the conference. I do not do field work, as I told my colleagues yesterday. I am a geneticist and a lab guy. So why did they want to hear me talking about eelgrass? Well, I've been collaborating with an ecologist for several years now, and I've been studying the population genetics of the zoster on Barnegat Bay. As I explained to the listeners yesterday at the conference, the health of an organism is not just determined by its physical health, but by its genetic health as well. In short, if you lose large parts of a population in any organism, you'll lose genetic diversity. Literally, by the way, genetic diversity is just how diverse the genome of an organism is in terms of differences between alleles. Die-offs, whether natural or induced by humans, lead to first a reduction in population sizes, obviously, and then to genetic bottlenecks or genetic drift, which limit genetic diversity. A bottleneck occurs when you start with a large population, and then through some disaster, you lose a large proportion of that population. You're left with a limited and not very diverse subpopulation. This leads to genetic drift as a smaller population starts to go through a process of crossing and repopulation. But the upshot is that you are left with reduced diversity at the end of the disaster. Finally, you also get isolation of populations as you start to get smaller and smaller ones, which leads to more inbreeding and reduced interpopulational gene flow, and then further loss of genetic diversity. The problem with limited genetic diversity is that it means that a population has less depth to its genome. You can kind of use a sports analogy here to understand this and compare a genome to a baseball team's bullpen. A good bullpen has lots of left and right-handed pitchers who can throw fastballs and change-up pitches and all sorts of stuff to deal with any situation that may arise in a game. If a bullpen only has right-handed fastball pitchers and nothing else, it has no depth and cannot deal with certain situations the team might get into with certain hitters. And the team will lose their season and probably be sold to another town when they go broke. Now imagine that the genome is the same in some sense. With limited diversity, the genome is similar to having only right-handed pitchers. It cannot adapt, and the organism is much more likely to die out. Now, we're not talking about a game here, but the actual survival of the organism. Here is a more practical example of why lack of genetic diversity is bad. Bananas, as we know them, are likely to die off in the next 10 years or so. The Cavendish variety of banana, a large, pulpy dessert banana that currently accounts for virtually all the world's trade, is being killed off by fungus. This amounts to nearly 20 million tons yearly. Unfortunately, with an 8,000-year-old genome, which is relatively new, the edible banana hasn't evolved to keep up with new pests. In short, it is not genetically diverse. The pests which are killing off the banana include the black Sigatoka leaf-destroying fungus, which has devastated vast acres of bananas. It cripples plants and reduces output by 50% or more. Close to half the banana crop in Uganda, for example, has been afflicted with this fungus as it spreads throughout the world. Bananas are the world's most exported fruit. Cooking bananas and plantains, eaten, fried, boiled, baked, or chipped, are the staple food of 400 million people in poorer countries. Commercial banana varieties are highly vulnerable to pests and diseases because they're near clones of each other. So a disease that strikes one could sweep them all out. And there you have the worst-case scenario of low genetic diversity and its effects. By the way, the banana has been wiped out before. In the 1950s, Panama disease wiped out the then-dominant commercial banana Gros Michel. Cavendish, which resisted the disease, was introduced then. But Cavendish could soon meet a similar fate. At any rate, my group has been examining different genetic alleles in populations of eelgrass plants all over Barnegat Bay. We look at the genetic alleles and statistically analyze things like frequency of heterozygosity versus homozygosity. Heterozygosity is particularly important because the more heterozygous a population is for certain genetic alleles, then the more diverse it is by definition. Remember, homozygosity means you have the same sequence at an allele on both your homologous chromosomes. And heterozygosity means you have different alleles at the two chromosomes, hence a greater level of diversity. So what did we find? Well, none of what we found was good news for the Bay. We found frequencies of heterozygosity, a mean of less than 30%, in all seven alleles that we examined in the Barnegat Bay populations. All those values were far lower than the 50 to 70% levels of heterozygosity expected. The values we found suggest a very low level of genetic diversity. We also calculated to determine what the probability that the plants were breeding only with themselves and their own populations was, that is, inbreeding, and not outbreeding with other populations. And we found a statistically very high rate of inbreeding among these Barnegat Bay plants examined. We also found evidence of genetic bottlenecks in five of the eight of the natural Barnegat Bay populations that we looked at. Again, a harbinger of limited genetic diversity. So what can we conclude? Well, our metaphorical canary, that is Zostera, is dying. The canary not only is suffocating because of the toxic fumes in the mine, but it can't even reproduce very well anymore to replace the dying canaries. My collaborators have been trying to replace and replant Zostera plants back into the ocean beds. There has been success at replacing lost beds both in Chesapeake Bay and in Boston Harbor, so this is not just a pipe dream. The lost plants can be replaced. The problem is that first we need to better understand the physiology and genetics of the zostera and be able to replace it in the long term and have it survive. And second, the conditions in Barnegat Bay need to get better so that the plants that we place back into the bay will not simply die off again. My own group is presently examining the genetics of restored eelgrass populations. One of my colleagues, Dr. Paul Bologna, Montclair State University, restored about a half dozen seagrass sites about 10 years ago now. I and some of my students have had the pleasure of the last few months of analyzing the genetics of these 10-year-old populations. They were originally planted with mixed sets of zostera from different areas around the bay in the hopes that a mixture of plants would induce some sort of hybrid vigor. But this was done blindly because 10 years ago, Dr. Bologna had no idea which of the plant populations that he was planting was the most genetically diverse. Our preliminary analyses of these populations suggest that they indeed have marginally more hybrid vigor after surviving for 10 years in the bay than the naturally developed populations. Although there is still genetic evidence for a good deal of inbreeding and far too low a heterozygote frequency in these planted populations, they are still on average doing better than the original populations from which they were derived. Additionally, we have good evidence that we were able to track which of these mixed populations predominated over the years and survived the best out of the four or so different plant sets that were restored at the different sites, which is a pretty good trick in my opinion. So the take-home story from all this is that New Jersey has a serious problem on its hands trying to save the bay now. The state EPA report on the bay, which we were given at the conference, cites 19 different key health factors of Barnegat Bay and notes that 11 of those 19 indicators have either shown no improvement in the last 10 years, or worse, they show evidence of severe decline. As long as the low levels of oxygen are present because of the high nitrogen contents, then we will continue to have problems, and animals and plants will simply not thrive in the bay. At least there is hope for saving the seagrass bed habitats because we are getting a better handle on how to replace them. But as my colleagues at the conference pointed out, until we get a handle on reducing the millions of pounds of nitrogen being put into the bay and actually ameliorating the crisis that brings about, then no amount of understanding about the genetics of zostera nor the work of restoration will do us any good. Let me close with an amusing story which developed today in connection with all this. The dean of my college emailed me today with a computer link and the broad question of whether the university had recently hired my brother. I had no idea what he was talking about. I checked out the link and it turned out to be a newspaper article that was published today in the Asbury Park Press. The article covered the Barnegat Bay Conference that took place there in Ocean County yesterday. The good news was that they freely and accurately quoted me several times in the article from some of the points I made at the conference. In fact, if you look up Barnegat Bay on Google, that article comes up as the first hit. The bad news is that they attributed those quotes to one Dr. Mark Campanella. I was completely flummoxed because despite the dean's unknowing joke, my brother, who's a lawyer, by the way, is named Mark. Well, although the print issues can obviously not be changed, I've already contacted the reporter of that article and asked him to please correct the online version of this minor travesty. Oh, and my brother was highly amused when I told him all about the story, given his complete lack of a science background. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, beware of reporters of any kind, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella. Good night.